Okay. We're on Perek Yud Chet, chapter 18. Apologies for the delay. It really is my fault, and I apologize. Anybody hear Rabbi Tarrigan speak last night? There was a shiur in Skokie. Anybody heard? He's in town from Gush. I was just chatting with him. Lovely man. Okay, so last week we did the first part of chapter 18 because it is notoriously long, over 50 verses, which I thought we could just read them one by one last week, but that would put us all to sleep, so why not split it in half? So, just to summarize last week, for those who were here, it'll be useful repetition. For those who weren't, hopefully it will be a helpful summary. We looked at it from two perspectives. Number one, what motivated this whole chapter? Chapter 18, beautiful poetry, wonderful artistry, what triggered it? Which moment in David's life? And we saw three approaches. We had, first of all, the Abarbanel, writing in Samuel in the book of Shmuel, because this chapter also appears almost word for word at the end of the book of Samuel. So he's writing, commenting at the end of Samuel, saying this, although it appears at the end of the book of Samuel, was actually written in David's youth, when he was young. And he wrote it because he knew there would be times of trouble, of crisis, which would be followed by divine salvation. And in that faith, he thought, I need to have a prayer. I need to be prepared. Anyone seen the Oscars? You know, when they get called up and they're like, oh, I had no idea. There were five nominees and you were one of them. Write a speech. Be prepared. So David, King David, knowing there would be moments when he needed eloquence, sat down and penned a psalm of thanksgiving, of praise. And that's what this is for the Abarbanel. This is written by a young hand, by a young mind. Rashi took the opposite approach and says, Kishehizkin. This is at the end of Samuel because it is written in David's old age. At a moment when he looks back over life, he can see the traumas he survived, the salvation that God provides. And in that wisdom, he pens this. And they're two radically images of a personality. A young, hopeful personality who looks out towards a life of crises, or an older person who looks back over life and has gratitude for survival. And you could see those both merging into this text. And in fact, that's what Rabbi Hirsch says. Rav Shimshon Nefal Hirsch says there are subtle shifts from the version in the book of Samuel to this chapter in Psalms. And those tiny little shifts that happen are reflective of David's maturing mind, of written as an older man making slight edits. Not complete scribbled out, but slight edits. One of which being, David calls himself an Eved Hashem in the first verse last week, which doesn't appear in the book of Samuel. And that is, we mentioned last week, the paradigmatic praise of a human being, being a servant of God. So that's what David's reflection on life is added. And then we looked at the structure of the text itself. That was motivation. Was he written as a young person like the Abarbanel suggests? As an older person like Rashi suggests? We noted that Ibn Ezra said that it wasn't just when he was old, but it was triggered by a particular moment. It wasn't just sagacious wisdom, the wisdom of a sage, but it was a moment in life when he got on his armor, put on his helmet, went to the front line, and they said, it's enough now. You've done your service. You've done your military time. Relax. So it wasn't just old age, but it was the promise of not being killed on a battlefield, that he served his country, his nation, his faith, and now he can recline after a life of service. So that was the two approaches we had, and Rav Hirsch stitched them together through the two books of Tanakh. Then we looked at the structure, which was split into three pieces. We had David's prayer when he's in crisis. One of the key phrases being, Afafuni chavle mavet. The bonds of death surround me. That was his prayer. And then we had the image of God being awoken in the heavens, tilting the clouds, coming down on a chariot, or not a chariot, but a cherub, with fire erupting, the ground shaking, God breaking through. And then the last we had God, David, talking about reward. When he finished with the word, Magenhu l'chol achosim bo, God is a shield for all who shelter in him. But that wasn't the end. That was midpoint. And now we find ourselves picking up verse 32, page 2, chapter 18. As I mentioned last week, this isn't the best speech to have written upon salvation, to have fluent in the mouth. It's not a brief, pithy thing. It's over 50 verses. Either way, in David's wisdom, he wrote it. So this section, the second section, is split into three pieces. If you have any questions at any time, jump out, shriek out, preferably relevant to what we're doing, but any question at all, I'll take. Page 2, the first section, is David's description of battle and victory. So again, in terms of setup, we've had three sections. We had the prayer in crisis, God's salvation, then David's description of reward for those who shelter in God, and now David, having described the general broad strokes, he goes to the actual scenes of liberation, which are the battlefield, where he was victorious. On page 3, we have two sections. The top three verses are consolidation of rule, David being grateful for a state, united states, we could call it. And then we finish, almost as always, with praise of God. So let's dive into the text. Top of page 2. Ki me Elohim baladai Adonai. Who is God except the Lord? Umitzur zulati Eloheinu. Who is the rock except our God? Ha'el ma'azreini chayel. The God who girds me with might. V'yiten tamim darki. And keeps my way tamim. Perfect. So this is praise of God. And the Radak has a strange reading that I couldn't quite comprehend. V'yiten tamim darki. This is talking about David being girded for battle and then saying his ways are perfect. The Radak says David is saying, not one of my men ever died in battle. And that's what makes my ways perfect, and that's what I'm grateful for. Which is the fear of every leader. Again, those who have seen West Wing, President Bartlett makes a remark at one point, there are very few days when there are black and white decisions, when there's simple right and wrong, and nearly every one of those days involves a body count. That's what he says at one point. And that's the greatest fear of every leader, that there will be body counts that they have to make. And David's claim of praise here is, V'yiten darki tamim, everything was perfect.
How is that factually correct?
Yeah, that's the problem. You look at
Tanakh. I'm thinking of the part in Shmuel with the cave, when a whole bunch of, with Avner and then some of David's men and a whole bunch of guys on both sides get killed.
So I'm pretty sure at one point he sends Uriah to the front line who gets killed too,
yeah,
right? So there's a whole, you could limit it and say he's talking about one particular war, one particular moment. The truth is, I don't remember what the Radak says, I just remember that he says this. I don't see the actual, he might be referring to one place. But this is what he says, no one died on battlefront. I'll have to take another look. But it adds to the poetic praise, if not the fact. Mashver ragli ka'ayalot. He made my legs like gazelles. Va'alba motaya amdenim stands me on the heights. He strategically prepared me to have pace and to have position. Melamed yadai lemilchama. He trained my hands at war. V'nichata keshet nechusha zorati. And he made my arms bend bows of copper. Which is a strange thing to say, but copper was notoriously difficult to bend, a very brittle metal that couldn't bend. And there's a midrash that jumps on this verse and actually says it used to be that kings of the world, different figures from different countries, would come and go into the Davidic palace, and they would see bows of copper lining the walls as ornaments. And they say this is just to intimidate us, because having a bow of copper shows that somehow it was bent, so it's an indication of strength. They said, that's just to intimidate us. David couldn't actually bend them. They're just there to intimidate us. And David gets up from the throne. He grabs up a straight pole and he bends it with his bare hands. And that scares them all to death. So that's what one midrash says on this. There's a different midrash that says that actually this is talking about David's arm that was unbendable. It had such strength that it couldn't be bent. So either way, David is praising God for teaching him warfare and giving him the muscle to carry it through. V'titen li magen yishecha, you gave me the shield of your rescue. V'yimincha tisadeni, your right hand sustained me. V'anvakcha tarbeni, and your battle cry made me many. Tarchiv tsa'adi tachtai, you lengthened my strides again, you quickened my pace. V'lo ma'adu karsulai, and my feet never tripped. And this word only appears once in Tanakh. So when it appears only once, what difficulty does that give us?
What does it mean?
What does it mean? We don't have any other context to compare it to. So everyone thinks it means something to do with the foot or the leg. But some people say, oh, it's the leg from the knee down. Some people say it's from the ankle down, halfway down the shin. Mm-hmm. You're thinking, who cares?
No, what's the matter for the sole of
the foot? Cuff.
No?
I was making that up. Kaf ragli is the foot, the sole of the foot. I think it might mean ankle in modern Hebrew. And that's what often people say, karasulai. And I was going to say, if you think karasulai, who cares, it's a challenge, because in discussions of Jewish modesty, often it will say people have to cover their legs ad karav sulai. So it may not bother us too much, but if you go to the local high school and you talk to the young women and you start talking about what karav sulai means, you can have a lot of tension depending on how you translate that. Does that mean the top of the knee, the middle of the shin, the ankle, the foot, the floor 5 feet behind you? No one really thinks that. Some people probably do. Either way, Laman Chet. So David is praising for letting my pace quicken, to have quick footsteps, and for not letting me trip. Laman Chet. Erdof oivaiva asigem. I pursued my enemies, and I caught them. Below Ashov ad kalotam, and I didn't turn back until they were gone. They were wiped out. Emchatsem velo yuchlukum. I smashed them, and they couldn't rise. Yiplu tachat radlai. They fell beneath my feet. Very vivid and quite vicious. V'tazreini chayla milchama, you girt me with the might for combat. Tachriya kamay tachtai, you laid my foes beneath me. V'oivai natatali, you gave me my enemies. Orethem asin ayats mitem, my foes, I demolished them. Yishava uva in Moshiach, they cried out, there was none to rescue. Al Adonai v'lo anam, to the Lord, they cried and he didn't answer them.
Which foes is he talking about? I mean, we have at least I have a different feeling if he's talking about the police team or possibly some of the other marauders he did than if he's talking about Shaul and the rest, you know, the rest of basically Bnei Yisrael.
Go on, why? What would you say?
I would say
police team.
He didn't demolish Shaul.
So I think, right, these are all excellent points. He was very different the way he performed in battle. We've got agreement, that's good. Consensus is excellent.
But he spent more time actually fighting Shaul.
That's true. Does anyone have last week's sheets with them by any freak chance? You don't have to go crazy. We got it there. Could you read the first verse by any chance? Because I think that helps our problem. You can read it Hebrew or English, whatever you like.
Vayomir Erechamcha, is it Erechamcha Adonai Chizki?
Maybe the verse before that.
Passion to view my Lord, you read.
The top one, right at the top, this little one. Read it in English, it's a long one.
For the lead player, for the Lord's servant, for David who spoke to the Lord the words of this song on the day the Lord saved him from the grasp of all his enemies and from the hand of Shaul.
Right.
Okay, all of them.
So while we're trying to look for nuance in his battle experience, it seems that this is actually an overarching claim for every enemy, every foe. At which point you could say, well, that's nice, but he didn't decimate Shaul. He didn't break him. And if we look at the next verse just before we pause, Vashat chen ka'afar al p'nei ruach, I crushed them like dust in the wind. Ketit chutzot arikem, like mud in the streets, I ground them. Yeah.
What did the Avarva know is his understanding?
That he wrote it as a young person?
He wrote it as a young man.
It seems to just be his poetic impression. I'm trying to think that. He just says, lots of people say this was written late in life, but my feeling is he wrote this when he was young to make it fluent for him.
Because young people usually don't expect, they don't feel vulnerable.
That's true. But I mean, on the other hand, it's interesting, and I guess it's poetic sensibility, but I think on the other hand, young people don't feel vulnerable, but often they feel more charismatic and creative. And you'll go to a local creative writing course at a high school, and they'll just come out with poetry that doesn't bespeak their life at all. And again, if he's writing this for the Abai Benel in anticipation of what's to come, could be he's writing speeches for what might happen. But your other point, both points are well taken. Your other point we still need to refer to, which is how can this be talking about Shaul? He's talking about crushing people in the dust. He never touches Shaul. In fact, he's mortified when he hears of Shaul's death. So we might want to rephrase this when he talks about all enemies, that this talks about enemies, foreign and domestic, external and internal. When you have internal foes, when you have internal qualms and doubts, and you crush them like dust. And this is about not just when he overcame Shaul, how he destroyed him, but how he destroyed himself in that confrontation. That's one way. One of the explanations we didn't get to is that this was actually the psalm David wrote when he heard about Shaul dying, which he regretted writing. And that's when we spoke weeks ago about the mistake, a shigayon, that he wrote something, that this is what he was confessing to. But that's not the way we've been looking at it, but it does seem reasonable based on the verse. Okay.
Wait a minute. What's the illustration of what?
I'm glad someone's paying attention. It is a foot, but you've got color there, right?
Yeah.
What is it foot in?
Mud.
Mud. Well, where do we have that? Like mud in the streets, I ground them.
Very clever.
Good, thank you. Got away with that. Not completely arbitrary, somewhat, but not completely. Okay, next page, next section. We've talked about victory on the battlefield, crushing them like dust, grinding them like mud with footprints. And now we have the next section, consolidation of rule. David thanks God for letting him rule under a united people. Mem Dalet. Tapalteni merive am, you saved me from the strife of peoples. Tesimeni l'rosh goyim, you set me at the head of nations. Im am lo yodati ya'avduni, a people I didn't know served me. Which is set up as an ideal, that I'm now this universal leader. In fact, one of the commentaries says, Tesimeni l'rosh goyim, you put me in charge of the nations, was actually David saying in relief, I'm actually in charge of people who aren't Jewish right now. Thank God, I can deal with them. So, somebody who had a difficult pulpit, presumably. Either way, that was one commentary. Mem hei, l'shamea ozen yishmuli, at the mere ears report, they obeyed me. They didn't need force, they didn't need swords, they didn't need impressing. All they need was the sound of my name, and they bent to my service. B'nei necha yichasha'uli, foreigners cringed before me. B'nei necha yibolu, aliens, not green people with multiple eyes, but foreigners did wither. V'yach ragu mimos rogateihem, and they filed out from their forts. So David wins the battles, and they come to serve him, and he's praising God for this. He's not putting it purely on his own hands, but he's saying God did it. Now the bottom praise of God. You're not going to ask about this illustration? Makes perfect sense. Okay.
It's a chef, but I don't understand chef.
Well, the one on the right is a king that's resigned to the one on the left.
Uh-oh.
There you go.
That's what you do when you
give up
the game. Okay.
Exactly. I once taught someone to play chess, and they beat me on their first game. So I'd advise. Thank you. Great teacher, bad chess player, but good teacher. Okay. Or I didn't know the rules, and I thought they beat me. Page 3, bottom. Praise of God. Chai Adonai v'aruch tzuri. The Lord lives, and blessed is my rock. V'yarum Elohai Yishi, exalted, the God of my rescue. And it's worth pointing out, the Minchat Shai, who is a grammarian, a medieval grammarian, points out that the word Elohai, Elohei, that appears often, right? That's not the only place it appears. But this is the only place in Tanakh where it appears male, full, meaning with a vowel. The only time. And one comment on this is that when you have salvation, God is filling up emptiness. It's filling in the vacuums, the doubts, the worries, making things full. That's a poetic rendering. Ha'el anoten nekamotli, the God who grants vengeance to me, v'idaber amim tachtai, and crushes the people beneath me. Mefalti ma'oivai, frees me from my enemies. Af min kamaita ramameni, yes, from those against me, you raised me. Me ish chamas tatzileni, you saved me from the men of Hamas, violence, let's say, which isn't what it means for the Hamas party. It means something else in Arabic. That would be a bit on the nose, the violent party. Nun Aleph, or Nun, Al Kain Odecha Bagoyim Adonai, therefore I acclaim you among the nations, O Lord, Ulushimcha Azameira, and to your name I would hymn. Migdol or Magdil, Yeshua Malko, Yoseh Chesed Limshicho, Le David Lazaro Adolam. Ose Shalom. Sorry?
You just finished eating.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah? That's true. Did you? Oh. Right. But this is, it's an excellent point, which just comes at the end of benching. The final verse to David's hymn maybe speaks to our experience in eating. Do we finish hungry like a youth who's anticipating? Or we finish sagacious and sated, looking back over the tribulations of the meal? Thank God we survived. But this is placed at the end. And it's worth noting, just for a side collector's item, the word is magdil here, and migdol in Shmuel. And what do we say in the weekend on Shabbat?
Migdol
on Shabbat. And there is a reasonable argument that that's actually a mistake. We're not meant to shift. And the reason it happened, who did? Oh, really? Oh, good. I'm in good company. So I'll mention it. Because the printers used to write next to the word Migdol, they put Shin Bet Dash. So people thought, oh, Migdol must be for Shin Bet Shabbat. Oh, so that must be for Shabbat, so we do Magdal during the week. But actually, Shin Bet was just a reference. It's in Shmuel Bet. People got confused, and that's what happened. So that's one argument. But we love arguments like that. It's like the whole cutting of the cake. Everyone used to cut it because their mother used to cut it, but that's because the pan was smaller. We don't need to get into that. Either way, who's been counting the words? Who's been counting how many words between this week and last week? No one? You focused on the foot in the mud, but not the number of words? Okay, I can't blame you.
As long as the foot is not in my mouth.
That's true. Then it can't count anything. Okay, good point. So, I didn't sit down and count the words, so I can't put hand on heart to this, but the Ma'orei Or did count it. So I'll give you his name. And he said that there are 365 words in this psalm as a whole. So you can either listen for the rest or you can count to the end. That's great. And he says this isn't the only place where 365 appears. Shirat Chana, until one of the important points, is 365 words. What else has it? Shirat Chana in its totality is 365. Shirat Devora is 365 until the crucial point at the end. Playing around there a little bit. And the number of words in the first and second tablets, the Luchot, put together at 365. So words of revelation at once, words of song from human being, words of God to man. 365 is totality, being given from one to the other, also resembling the solar year, 365. Okay. I won't mention it. And he also makes a point that Ketoret, the incense, had 365 different besamim in it. Blend. So it is the unifying number. So either way, now we've said that, we've done 18. We've spoken about old age last week. We spoke about forgetfulness and dementia. We spoke about David writing as an older person. And now we spoke about here, David being saved in redemption from the battlefield. Top of page 4, this text, not only the final verse and benching, but as a whole, has a liturgical place. In some traditions. Top of page 4, Maaseh Rav. By the end, we're going to know who Maaseh Rav is about. Anyone know? Maaseh Rav is a book which literally means the actions of the rabbi. But it's not just any rabbi. This is about the Vilna Gaon. After the Vilna Gaon passed away, one of his students compiled a book called Maaseh Rav, which goes through all his customs that he used to do at various times. And in fact, I don't know if they have it here, but there were 3 volumes published by Rav Shechter in New York about Rav Soloveitchik. One, all called something else, Rav. Divrei Harav, something Harav. I think one of them is Maaseh Harav. There's a Harav, so as not to plagiarize. But lots of times, students pen down the customs of their teachers. So one of the customs he wrote down was what the Shir Shal Yom was every day. We've got Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. Shabbos, Shir Shal Yom. Some people have special Shir Shal Yom, special psalm of the day, for Chagim too. And the Gra, the Vilna Gaon, was one of them. Look at the underlined bit. Shvi shel Pesach, and on the seventh day of Pesach, Yudchet, Lemnatzeach, Le'eved Hashem, etc. Seventh day of Pesach is when he said this psalm. That took him until the Seder, I guess. It's a long psalm. But that was Shir Shal Yom. Can you imagine after Shachar having to say 51 verses? So, it was on the seventh day of Pesach. And Rabbi Gifta, who last time I didn't know when he passed away and when he lived, from 1915 till 2001, and it was Rosh Hashiva in Cleveland, he wrote that it's not coincidental. It wasn't just randomly struck. The Gra didn't just like the poetry. But the relevance of redemption, of salvation, and there are actually words in last week's section, for those who have it can look back, there are words about being saved from water, being down to our necks in water and God pulling us out. He said, what happens on 7th day Pesach, 21st of Nisan? Big miracle, I'll give you a clue. Splitting of the sea, the clue is the picture on the page. There we go, somehow relevant. Seventh day Pesach, the sea is split. And that is for him, Rabbi Gifter says, for the Gra, a foreshadowing of every redemption. That is what it feels like to be saved. Miraculous. When we've been through crises, and we've all been through crises, some more critical than others, we feel like we're drowning beneath water and have that broken up for us. That is the feeling of salvation, and that's why this psalm was picked for the seventh day of Pesach, which is coming up in just a couple of weeks. Exciting. But before we get carried away with that imagery, which we'll come back to, I wanted to look at the last box on this page, the bottom box, to see what else happened on the 21st of Nisan. Rabbi Chanina bar Papa Omer Ota Hayom Esrim Ve'echad B'Nisan. On that very day of the 21st of Nisan, Haya Omer Malachi Hasharet Lifnei Kadosh Baruch Hu. The angels plead out to God, and they said to him, Ribon HaOlamim, Master of the Universe, and there's something going on which they're talking about, which I'll tell you in a moment. Misha Atid Lomar Shira Al Hayam Bayom Zeh. The person who in the future will sing a song about the sea on this very day. Yilakeba Mayim Bayom Zeh should be struck down in water on this day. And it's referring to the day Moshe was put in the little basket and put down the Nile. And that happened, according to this Midrash, on the 21st of Nisan. That was foreshadowing the eventual day when he would stand at the sea split and sing in salvation. And he's protected. The angels say he's now put in this basket. Anything could happen. If you saw the Prince of Egypt, the Disney version, I don't know if you did, they actually have the scene where he's going along the river and it's clear that God is guiding him because there are alligators jumping at him, hippos jumping at him, elephants jumping. I don't know if they're in water, but everything's jumping at him and he seems to go up dark and dive all the way until he lands peacefully in the palace. And somehow, this Midrash is capturing the danger, the anxiety the angels have in heaven. Moses, a baby, a three-month-old baby, is in a basket on a river, surrounded by agents who want him dead, in nature. And the angels say, let him get through, because he will sing about song. And somehow, they can't take the irony. That's what it seems to be. He's going to sing about water. You can't kill him with water. A fire, maybe, but not on the river. It kind of heightens it. They couldn't cope with the irony and the tragedy. But the point of this Midrash I wanted to mention about the 21st of Nisan and this psalm is that not all miracles feel like a splitting of the sea. Despite me trying to convince you a moment ago that that's the feeling of salvation, that's not always true. There are crises that have a slow ebb, that ease out, that are subtle and slow and quiet and gentle, like a baby quietly in a basket meeting his destiny. Sometimes it's all flaring, you feel like it's in public, you feel just saved, and sometimes it's just a quiet relief. And that happens both on this day, which the Gra picked for this psalm. That said, I want to turn back. We've got Pesach in a couple of weeks. We've mentioned the seventh day of Pesach, saying Shirat Hayam. I want to talk about the splitting of the sea, because I think we have an excellent way in, and we can talk about love, because why not? What better thing to talk about on Pesach? We sing Shir Shirim, the Jewish book of love. And I thought we can explore love through, and this doesn't just mean love of a spouse, this means love of human being, of friends, of family, of strangers. It just means the emotion of love. Why? Top box, page 5, tell you exactly why. Amar of Yochanan, and this is off-quoted, this piece. Rabbi Yochanan said, V'kashin lezavgan k'kriyat yamsuf. It is as challenging and difficult to find a partner as it is to split the sea.
Does this have to do with that Roman matron story?
Go on.
Oh, there was a story, I don't remember which rabbi it was in the Roman times. Some Roman matron says to him, well, what's your God doing now that he's done creating the world? He can't have anything to do. And then he says, well, he makes shidduchim. I can do that. And so she pairs up all her servants, and then they all end up with busted arms, black eyes, everything the next day, and she realized, not that easy.
Thematically, it's on the nose. Very welcome. I don't know if it appears right in this text. I'll have to look again. But it is the point. It is not easy. And the simple meaning of this text is exactly that. That finding a partner is sometimes insurmountable. All you have to do is go to New York and they'll give you a PowerPoint presentation on the shidduch crisis about the problems and how difficult it is. But I think it can't be incidental. It can't just be, we need a metaphor for challenge. It's difficult to find partners. And the rabbis are searching around, how can I best exemplify? What's the best way to teach people how difficult it is? Oh, it's like splitting the sea. They could have said it's like lifting a wall. They could have said anything. So I think there's something specific about the mechanics of this miracle, the way that the sea split, that captures the struggle to find love, not just, again, with partners, but with family and friends. So why? Why do I think that's true? And we're going to explore three dimensions of this miracle, hopefully giving us an insight into three key dimensions of what it means to love. So the first one is, what is water? We're talking about water, we're talking about water splitting, getting through it. So I wanted to talk about this first passage from Dine Moshe Swift, who was a Dine in London, a rabbi in California for a while, so he'd been east and west. And he wrote a piece about a verse from Esau, from Lamentations, that we say on Tisha B'Av. And this is the verse. Ki gadol kayam shivrecha mir pelach. And this is a harrowing sentence when you're reading Esau and Tisha B'Av. We're looking over, Jeremiah's looking over the desolation, the destruction. He's thinking about exile, unending wandering. And he says, gadol kayam shivrecha, your break, your breach is as great as the ocean. Mir pelach, who can heal you? And this, in its simple meaning, is just a quantitative statement. The ocean is massive. And if anyone needs convincing, you just have to look at exactly the news of the last 2 weeks. However we think we are in technological progress, there are parts of this earth we can't access. We're not in control. And that is our break when we're in exile. That's what Jeremiah identifies. We're just lost. We're never going to find a way out. And Rav Moshe Swift has a slightly different take. A disaster on dry land can be commemorated. The spot is known, a memorial can be set up. Monument erected to remind men of the tragedy that took place on that spot. But if a ship meets disaster on the high seas, the raging waters cover it up. No sign is left, no point can be marked. Nothing can be set up to remind men of the tragedy that once took place there. It is not just a quantitative statement. It's not just about physical scale, but about psychic torture. Because the sea is not just immense, but it is unstable, shifting. We can't put up a monument like we have on street corners and town halls. We set up at mass graves and camps. That's impossible on the sea. Because it floats away, it moves away.
But isn't Jewish history the history of the sea as opposed to, I mean, we get kicked out of every country, so what good is it to put up a monument? I mean, our monument is the Torah or Tanakh. It's words that we can take with us. It isn't a place where we can put up a plaque to remember how awful that, you know, or what commemorate what happened here. It always has to be internalized because we're always moving.
I think you're right, and I think you're in agreement with him. I think he's identifying what you're saying. Mm-hmm. He's saying that Jeremiah is looking out to Jewish history and he's seeing exactly that sentiment. That we're always on the move. Yet, when we say Gadol Kayom Shivracha, we don't just mean you've got a huge break. We mean your break is going to be unmemorable. You're not going to be able to set up memorials. Because if we look back to our, we all trace our family history, we're going to have memorials set up in 15 different continents. It's not in one place. That is what's being identified. And he's seeing that as Gadol Kayam. That is what water is. It is this unstable, unsteady, always shifting, always moving thing. And then when the Jews are chased to the sea, Egyptians at their back, they're facing this ocean, they have to be contemplating the image of that unstable and shifting nature. So that's what we're breaking through. That's the challenge of love, to split that sea, to get through the instability and the shakiness, to find firm ground. So that's the first thing, water as a whole. Now let's look at the three elements. Number one, we're going to look about the dynamics of the divide. What happens when they split the sea? You can call that. Water split, what happens?
Someone starts to sing.
Someone starts to sing. What about the geography? They walk on
dry land.
But it's divided into 12 sections.
So there's a midrash, it's divided into 12 sections. According to everybody, if we look just to the physical dynamics, what's happening is the ground that has never before been exposed, never before been seen, is open to sunlight. And that's the first thing about love. You have to be prepared for vulnerability. You have to be prepared to open up, to share dreams, anxieties, fears, hopes, prayers. You have to allow yourself to be exposed. And that can be scary, that can be fearful, and that's part of what the challenge is that Rabbi Yochanan identifies. It is as tough as splitting the sea to find a partner. Not just it's incredibly difficult, but it identifies some of the mechanics of this miracle. Finding love involves peeling back the blankets which we shroud ourselves in, finding the ability to confer, to confess, to have conversation. And further than that, because that is scary, I want to take something from the Me'am Loez, who has a midrash, which paints a beautiful picture of what actually appeared on that dry land. I don't know if you've come across this before. I found it quite striking. Third box. Kikarka hayam nityavsha v'lona asit gush echad. The seabed dried up. It didn't become one platform. Ela psipas, which is a Hebrew word meaning mosaic. Kamo bateim shel gedolei malchut hamritzafim ba'avnei shesh mesidrat yafa, like they have in these royal houses where they have marble pieces beautifully arranged on the floors. And this is what it means in a verse. So the Me'am Loez claims, we've got this image in our mind of the sea opening up, the dry ground appearing a little bit muddy, a couple of bits of seaweed, a couple of dead fish that were caught by surprise, and they're walking along through this dry land. He says, no, that is not what happened. And this might not be a historic claim, but somewhat mythic or legendary, but it actually appeared to have this striking, beautiful mosaic. So they went forth under mosaic leadership and on top of a mosaic platform, because mosaic also means from Moses. So that, and this I think speaks to the impact of what having a relationship with friends, with family, with others, with a spouse, with a partner can do. Because despite the vulnerability, when you open up, you actually find that the fragments, the shards of shattered dreams, the chipped away hopes, cohere into a unified being. Those little fragments that you feel separate you come together, you feel purpose, you feel steady. It was Aristotle who said human beings are social animals. And in finding real relationships, we come together as unified personalities. So that's the first part. And it's worth mentioning something Virginia Woolf once said. That is an excellent, excellent observation. And I'll tell you why, because when I wrote it, I copied it out the book, and I wrote in the quote the book had, and then I looked it up because I wanted to double check, and it was wrong. But I can't remember which one was right. My guess would be that Psalms is correct, because I was copying out the Hebrew, so I would have copied out Habakkuk and then looked it up. But we can look it up in our spare time. And it was Virginia Woolf who wrote in her book The Waves, about water. It's actually about friendship and loneliness as well. And it goes through, it's fascinating, wonderful book. A friend bought it for me a few years ago, and she begins each chapter with a description of the day. Starts out with dawn, goes through to midday, then dusk, then night, and we follow a person through life. Friends at nursery, going through school, high school, university, military, splitting up over life, meeting again at an old age reunion, and then being left alone when friends pass away. And it's a very, very moving rendition of life's ebbs and flows, of waves. Yeah. It's called The Waves.
The Waves.
The Waves. And she writes at one point that in relationships one has to be willing to lay bare the pebbles on the shore of one's soul. And that is exactly what we're talking about. The Me'am Loez moves it, not just pebbles, but you have to be willing to have faith that those pebbles are going to cohere into a wonderful image. And that's why I've got pebbles on the shore of a soul, on the shore of a beach over there. Okay, that was the first part. We've got another few minutes. Two more boxes. And this is also very important. And with Pesach coming, these are things you can share at the Seder, things you can just think about. Three dimensions of the splitting of the sea. The first one was, you have to be able to open up, to expose yourself, which often leaves a mosaic. That's number one. Number two, the Rabbeinu Bachya, who's got a fascinating idea. Because again, we've seen the Ten Commandments, we've seen the Prince of Egypt maybe, we've seen these movies, so we've all got impressions of what this event actually looked like. But the Rabbeinu Bachya has something which I haven't seen animated anywhere. Although the movie Exodus is coming out at the end of the year with Christian Bale starring as Moses. So maybe...
Oh my God.
Yeah, maybe Batman, Moses, same guy. No, not quite. Vigilante, saving people on the side. Not really. Either way. Noah just came out. And it's got critical acclaim. Some good criticism, some bad criticism, but it definitely got acclaim. Okay. I've been told it's worth seeing, and then someone told me there are weird things going on. That
I read the book.
Right.
You're right.
It's true. Always spoils the book, doesn't it? Maybe you can tell us how it ended. That will save us going.
Next week.
Okay. Sure. Also, but Hermione wasn't in the book, and Hermione's in the movie, so now we've got to go. Okay. Second thing what happened. Lo nikrahayam lahem b'yachad. The sea did not split for them at once. From one end to the other, whether 12 or one channel, the sea did not split, vroom, down the middle. Ella, ma'at, ma'at, bit by bit. Ki hayam haya nas mit pineihem, the sea would move from before them. Umidei avram hayu roam hayam leneihem, and while they were walking, they were facing a wall of water. It didn't split, and they could see in the horizon this path toward freedom. It just split a bit, and they had to take a step, and they had to take another step, and every time they moved, it moved with them. And I think this could be a second dimension to what building relationships takes. A necessity of love is not just the willingness to be vulnerable and open up, but the willingness to not know how it ends. The willingness to take one step at a time, to be blind beneath the shadows of fate and the future, and to still have that courage to hold someone's hand and to move forward. And that is the second dimension, I think, is central, which is simplified again by Rabbi Yochanan. It is as challenging to have love as to split the sea, not just difficult, but it involves the necessities to have courage, to take one step at a time.
A leap of faith.
A leap of faith, precisely.
What did
he base this on? Rabbeinu Bachya? No idea. It's an excellent question, but I mean, what triggered? It could have been a creative imagination. I need to take another look.
There's something in the text.
Right. That would be the assumption. There's got to be something in the text. I think here there might not have been. It might have just been a tradition he heard. It took me actually hours to find this text because someone I just heard in a sermon somewhere a couple of years ago. Rabbeinu Bachya says. And that's really helpful. Rabbeinu Bachya says, where am I going to look that up? So I started looking around, and eventually I found it in the middle of an introduction, which was like 5 pages long, just hidden there. So I don't remember. I don't think he relates it to a bit of text. I think he just says...
You didn't Google it?
That's how I found it eventually. What do you think I am? I think I know books? No. It took me... Firstly, I looked on the page in the books, and then you're right, and I'm like, no. Internet, that's where we go. Bar Ilan program, excellent. Anyone use the Bar Ilan program? Bar Ilan computer program has got every sefer you can think of. It's got the whole of Chumash. Before you write it down, you should know it is very expensive. $500 for a CD on the computer. But it's got the whole, and it's not in translation, it's all in Hebrew, but it's got the whole of Tanakh, the whole of Talmud, the whole of Midrash, the whole of Halachic works, the whole of every response that basically ever written, every minhag, every mitzvah, it's unbelievable what is on this. And that's how most rabbis you'll go to will make source sheets, unless they're photocopying. Not everyone sits there typing. You copy and paste out of that program. Okay.
Is there supposed to be a difference then between, the Seder night,
yeah,
when there's this miracle, and you hear about how deliverance, no matter how bad something is, it can come just like this, just like a split second. But the Red Sea is a slower experience where the people have to take one step after another without knowing whether this wall of water is going to come back on them. So there are two different experiences?
You're right. I mean, I think it's layers of experience. Because I think within that slow miracle, it's not just fear that you feel. But fear is added. You feel this could collapse, but it also heightens your awareness of how miraculous this is. Because when it just splits, okay, first minute, this is pretty impressive, and then this is my status quo. It's set up. But now I'm walking, and it's moving every step. Yes, the anxiety is huge, but I'm now hugely conscious, too, of the fact that this is being held up for me. So you're right, but there's more than one layer to what's going on. Okay, because we've got 2 minutes left, according to my clock, actually 13 seconds. We're going to do the final box, and I'm going to read it incredibly quickly. And then we're going to think about the third dimension. We'll read this in 1 second. The third dimension is what happened. The Jews go in, and the water shifts and moves. The Egyptians go in, and it collapses. Because this is also not just about the way you enter, the way you begin love, the way you enter this realm, but what your aspirations are. And the Jews went in to find freedom for themselves, for others. They went in to liberate. The Egyptians went in to expand dominion and rulership and tyranny. And when anyone enters a relationship for the motivation of conquest, I want to conquer that personality, I want them to be mine, it's going to come crashing down on you. Because love is about liberation. And this was best put by Geoffrey Chaucer. Well, maybe not best put, but it was put by Geoffrey Chaucer. And this was quoted about the time of the royal wedding. Which is why I need to say it, because I need to feel English. And this is the words that he said. When mastery cometh, the god of love anon beateth his wings and farewell, he is gone. When mastery cometh, love disappears. Because they don't mix. If you want to love, you want to build relationships, you cannot come with the intention of ownership. Like the Egyptians, they come in, it crushes down on them. There's one midrash also in the Me'on Loeth that they didn't drown in the water. What happened is they entered and God sent down a wind that stirred up the mud and they drowned in tar as vengeance for all the tar they made the Jews trample in. So there's something about mastery. When mastery cometh, the god of love anon, and it collapses. So when Rabbi Yochanan says it's so difficult to find a partner, to make love, it's not just difficult. And this isn't just a way of finding a big dramatic metaphor. But it's key elements drawing from one to the other. It has. You need the difficulties in love, again, with spouse, family, friends, or strangers, to open up, to allow yourself to be vulnerable, to take risks. You need to be able to have courage to take one step at a time, to hold hands and jump off a cliff and see where you go. That might not be the best metaphor. Don't jump off any cliffs. Just walk up against big walls of water. And then the third, I don't want people coming to me and saying, what are you teaching? We had three people jumping off a cliff yesterday. Yeah, exactly. And the third thing is the aspiration of liberty. When you love somebody, whether it's a child, a parent, a friend, you have to want them to feel free. You have to want the aspiration of loving them to make them better people for themselves, not better for you, but help draw out their potential, their personality, their hopes and dreams. And it's hugely tempting, and I speak from very limited experience. Before I was married, I went to Gush in Israel, which is notoriously open-minded, and I see myself as a relatively open-minded liberal person. And I would always talk about women's rights. Women should not be in the kitchen. They should not be doing the cleaning. Their jobs are not just to look after kids. For me, I want to find a woman who has got her own ambitions. But then when you get married and you realize I need to eat, it is hugely tempting to say, oh, can you just make the food? Can you just do this? It's hugely tempting. But love is not about finding somebody who you can then use to your own ends. I have to conquer that temptation often to say, that is not what I married someone for. That is not what I have friends for, to have uses for them. I have to make them the best they can be. And if that means I'm washing the dishes, or I'm making dinner one night, or I'm sacrificing to do something for them, that's what love is. And my wife followed me to Chicago for something I needed to do. Mm-hmm. And at some point in life, I hope I can move somewhere for her too. So that's three dimensions of love. Number one, being vulnerable. Number two, having courage. And number three, liberating the other. So now we've done chapter 18. We had a little bit of a detour through Pesach topics. And next week we do chapter 9.